Jennifer Thompson was a 22-year-old North Carolina college student, described as the perfect daughter, the perfect student, and the perfect homecoming queen. But life's perfections were radically changed on a hot summer night when an assailant held a knife blade to her throat and viciously raped her. She resolved that she would remember every detail of his appearance. She tricked him into turning the light on. She memorized every feature so that she could report it to the police and do something to make sure that her enemy would spend the rest of his life in prison. The police were amazed at her decisiveness when the composite picture was developed. She knew everything about his nose and his eyes and his chin and his ears. She knew everything about him. And then when they presented a lineup, she quickly and decisively chose Ronald Cotton as the man who fit the description and the man who had assaulted her. In the trial, there was circumstantial evidence. There was inconsistency in his alibis. There was his previous arrest record. But most of all, it was the decisive and confident testimony of the assaulted white woman against the accused black assailant. The jury unanimously convicted, and Ronald Cotton was sentenced to the rest of his life in a North Carolina prison. Jennifer Thompson never had a doubt. A year after the conviction, Ronald Cotton met a man named Bobby Poole in the prison kitchen. They looked a lot alike. And then a story came around the prison grapevine, and Ronald Cotton heard that Bobby Poole, who was himself a convicted sex offender, who was serving consecutive life imprisonment terms, was saying that he was the one who had really raped Jennifer Thompson, and that Ronald was serving his time. Ronald Cotton hated Bobby Poole, and so he secured a contraband knife and plotted to take the life of the man who had gotten him into jail. He confided in his father his murder plans, and his father told him, "You insist that you are innocent, but if you kill Bobby Poole, you deserve to spend the rest of your life in prison. What you need to do is get rid of the knife. What you need to do is put your faith in God. What you need to do is believe." Some lawyers took a special interest in the case, and the judge agreed to a new trial for Ronald Cotton. This time the jury heard the rest of the story. This time they saw both men and saw their similarity in appearance. This time they again convicted Ronald Cotton on the basis of the confident testimony of Jennifer Thompson, the eyewitness. And again, Ronald Cotton was sentenced to serve the rest of his life in prison. 11 more years passed, years in which Jennifer Thompson sought to get on with her life. She moved to Winston-Salem. She married. She had a family. She had triplets. She tried to put all of this behind her. But then one day, there was an unexpected knock at her door. And then she saw a man that she had not seen for a very long time. It was the police detective who had originally investigated the case. When she opened the door, he said, "Jennifer, you were wrong. That the new technology of DNA evidence has proved conclusively that Ronald Cotton was innocent. Your assailant was Bobby Poole, after all." Jennifer Thompson was shocked, just absolutely shocked. How could this have happened? How could she have made such a terrible mistake? Ronald Cotton was set free from prison, and the state of North Carolina offered him $5,000 in compensation for 11 years of his life. She had stolen 11 years of a man's life that could never be given back. She agonized over this every day for 2 years until finally she decided what she needed to do. She contacted the police detective and asked if he could set up a meeting between her and Ronald Cotton. And so the meeting was set for a church building in the community where the initial rape had taken place. There were four that were there that day. It was Jennifer and her husband, Ronald Cotton, and the pastor of that church. The pastor and the husband waited out in the parking lot while Jennifer and Ronald met for the first time outside a courtroom. It was Jennifer who spoke first. She said, "I'm sorry. If I spent every day for the rest of my life telling you how sorry I am, it wouldn't come close to what I feel." And then it was Ronald Cotton's turn to speak. Calmly and quietly, he said, "I'm not mad at you. I've never been mad at you. I just want you to have a good life." They talked together in that church building for 2 hours. My guess is that the pastor and husband were anxiously waiting out in the church parking lot. Then finally they came out. And it was time for everyone that day to say goodbye. And Jennifer and Ronald embraced. And they held each other for a long time. It was a few days after that that Jennifer decided what she needed to do next. And that was that she needed to make contact with Bobby Poole. And so she wrote a letter to him in prison. She asked to meet him. In that letter, she wrote, "I faced you with courage and bravery that July night. You never asked my permission. Now I ask you to face me." She wanted to meet him so that she could forgive him. She reasoned that if Ronald Cotton could forgive her, then she could forgive Bobby Poole. From the words of Jesus, "You have heard that it was said, 'Love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that?" You see, Jesus recognized what was normal and natural and common behavior, and that is to love your neighbor, but to hate your enemy. Some of us have more enemies than others of us. Enemies that have come to us through circumstances that are beyond our control. We are assaulted, cheated, abused, hated, disliked. It may be because of the color of our skin or because of the job that we hold or the family to which we belong. It may be because of some position or money that we have or prejudice against us. It happens because war is happening. And others hate us simply because of the war in the country that we belong to. Or it may simply be that the circumstances are that we're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Circumstances that we cannot control. But we get enemies not just from circumstances, we get enemies from choice. And that we can control. No one can ever be our enemy unless we choose for that person to be our enemy. Someone else may label us as an enemy, but no one can ever be our enemy without our prior consent. Some of us have so many enemies because we have a very low threshold and we allow just about anybody to get on the list. Anyone who disagrees with us in terms of politics or religion or personally or for a whole host of reasons. The enemy is anyone who does something we don't like. This past week, Charlene and I were on a flight from Minneapolis to Calgary, Alberta. And we got on the plane, and I was seated in the aisle seat, and she was in the center seat. And although the flight was very full, the window seat was empty right up to the last moment before they closed the door. And this man arrived, assigned to the seat in our row, with, let me just tell you, more carry-on luggage than you're supposed to have. I'm just an awful lot. And he came in, and then he started opening all the overhead bins, which were just jammed full. So he couldn't get in there his suitcase, or his attaché case, or the other bag, or his coat, or any of the other things that he had with him. And so he started carrying them over the top of us, going into this window seat. And I was beginning to wonder if the laws of physics actually had been set aside. Was it physically possible for this man and everything to fit there? Well, he plopped down with these things in front of him and under him and on top of him and probably knew that the flight attendant was going to come around and say that this was unacceptable. So then I saw what he did. He started looking at the space where my feet were. He's watching the space over by me. And I knew what he was thinking. And he turns to us and said, So are you two traveling together? And I wasn't sure whether I wanted to admit to that or not. And then he said, well, could I put my stuff over there in front of me? And Charlene says, oh, sure. I mean, like, that was her decision to make. So he hands his attaché case and pushes it there where my feet were supposed to go. So here I am all sort of crumpled up, and I didn't like him. I did not like him at all. He comes on at the last minute. We were there early. We were the ones that filled the overhead bins. We're the ones who had every right to that space. And my animosity toward him, it wasn't boiling, but the temperature was rising. And then, okay, I'll confess to you. Then I recalled what we'd be talking about this weekend. And I thought to myself, oh, come on, Leith, lighten up, lighten up. This guy's not the enemy. This guy's a fellow traveler. This is somebody who needs something that I've got. I can help him out. This is not going to determine the outcome of my life. Come on. Don't make him someone on the enemy list. So who might our enemies be? Enemies are our competitors. Competitors in sports, competitors in business, competitors in romance and law and religion, competitors in our professions and in our politics. Enemies sometimes are strangers in war with gender or culture or race. Often our enemies are our neighbors. They're the people who are in the same row that we're on in the aircraft, or they're the ones who have an address that's a couple digits different from ours. They're the ones who make our lives difficult. They're the ones who invade our space. They're the ones who disturb our peace or offend our preferences. And there are assailants. Assailants who harm our families and steal our possessions. They're the ones who take away our rights. Our rights. And sometimes assailants who actually assault our bodies. But if you add all of them together, I think they're a small minority. The vast majority of our enemies are people whose names we know. The vast majority of our enemies are those who are closest to us. They're our co-workers. It's the boss, the employee. Sometimes it's mother or father, daughter or son, brother or sister. They are the people around whom the controversies of our lives swirl in divorces and lawsuits and custody battles over broken contracts and offensive words. They are the ones to whom we don't speak or we look the other way or cross the street or move to a different place in the hallway so that we don't have to have contact. They're the ones with whom we have little to do except the unkind words that we speak behind their back to somehow lower them in the esteem of others. They are the ones the ones toward whom we have animosity, anger, and hurt. According to Jesus, you have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. So who do you hate? Who's on your list? Who comes to mind? Who has so hurt you? Who has so deeply offended you? Who is it that is the most difficult person in your own history to love? And if you're unsure who's on your list, or if we want to get a more accurate reading, let me ask not you, but the people who know you the very best, the ones with whom you let down your guard, let me ask them who your enemies are. Jesus called Christians to absolutely radical behavior in relationship to these enemies. It may be the most revolutionary teaching in all religion or by any religious leader. It distinguishes Christians from non-Christians, I think, as much or more than anything else. Jesus said to love your enemies. Now, of course, he recognized that there are different types of love. It is not suggesting that we have the same emotional affection toward a murderer as toward a mother. It is not suggesting that we have an emotional attachment toward a molester that is anything similar to the child that is molested. Love for family and friends, that's something that comes from the heart. When you see a new baby, you love that baby. You don't think much about it, you just do it. When you fall in love with someone you want to marry, it's a matter of the heart and the emotion. But love for enemies is different, coming not from the heart, but from the will, that we choose to love someone whom our hearts may not even like. Loving our enemies is deliberately choosing against bitterness and choosing for benevolence. It is doing the supernatural rather than the natural. Loving our enemies means that we choose the highest possible good for them, even if they have inflicted the worst possible harm upon us. Sometimes it is even a tough love, a love that they don't want, that they don't like, that they may misunderstand. But it is always doing what is good and best for the other person. How do you do that? How do you seek good for someone who is your enemy? Jesus gave a list, 5 items in the list. He said, 1, pray for those who persecute you. Every day, pray and ask God for the very best in the life of your enemy. Pray for your enemy. Don't pray that they'll get sick. You know, don't pray that they'll die. Don't pray that they'll have a car accident or lose a job. Pray that good things will happen to them. It may be the hardest thing ever done in life, but in the end, it may be the best thing ever done in life. 2nd on Jesus' list is to behave like God's child. For Jesus invited us to love our enemies so that we may be the sons and daughters of our Father in heaven. That we belong to the family of God, and as part of the family of God, we absorb the love of God until it is the love of God that not only transforms us, but controls us. That means then that we are no longer controlled by the misbehavior of others. They don't have control over our choices. God does. How is that shown in the family? God's Son, Jesus, prayed for forgiveness for his executioners while they were hammering the spikes into his hands and feet. 3rd on Jesus' list is to follow God's example. Jesus explains that God causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Theologians call that common grace, that God is good to his enemies. He's good to those who hate him, who sin against him. He gives them the sunrise, and he gives to them the rain. He gives to them kindness and graciousness. He does not discriminate and punish them. God is gracious in the day-to-day operation of his world. And so he asks us to be gracious and generous and kind, even to our enemies. Fourth on Jesus' list is to get God's reward. Jesus said, if you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Apparently implying that there are special rewards that come from God for Christians who love their enemies. But I think it's more than that. I think it's a matter of faith. Because what we do is we assume that our enemy has somehow shorted us or cheated us so that at the end we will not end up with the best. And Jesus says, don't worry about that. Leave that to God, who will reward in the end, and he will make everything turn out all right. Trust him. Don't seek revenge. And fifth and last on Jesus' list is simply to be different from non-Christians. He points out that the very worst of people love their family and friends, that while that's good and right, it's not at all unusual. Even pagans do that, but Christians, we are different. We are controlled by God. We love our enemies because we're Christians. Nelson Mandela, for most of his adult life, was in prison in South Africa under the laws of apartheid. And then history took a spin that hardly anybody could have predicted. Not only was Nelson Mandela set free and internationally recognized, but the laws of South Africa changed. They abandoned apartheid, came up with a new constitution, had an election, and whoever would have dreamed that the once rebel black leader, Nelson Mandela, became the president-elect of the Republic of South Africa. So the heads of state and their delegations from around the world wanted to come to his inauguration, and they were vying for the best seats at that inauguration. President-elect Mandela had to decide who would sit in the honored places in the front row. Would it be the delegation from the People's Republic of China or from the United States of America? From the United Kingdom? From some nation in Asia or Europe or South America? Who would get the places of honor? He chose his prison guards. Jesus said, love your enemies. It is a Christian choice to which Jesus Christ supernaturally invites us. Who are your enemies? How will you love them? Our God, without your help, this would be impossible. But it is possible. Through Jesus Christ, who loved us, through your Holy Spirit inside of us, through the supernatural power that you give to us from heaven to earth. Lord, may these be more than words from an ancient document. May these be the realities of the life that we live, that we love our enemies for Jesus' sake.